Thank you for that lovely introduction, Michael. It's a pleasure to be here, and I will certainly do my best to navigate through today how we're thinking about current conditions and what it might mean for the economy here. That's exactly what I'm going to be talking about. Before I begin, though, I'd like to start by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land on which we are meeting today, the Yuggera and Turrbal people of Meanjin, and pay my respects to elders past and present. And thank you very much to the Economic Society of Australia, Queensland branch, for having me up here today to talk to you. It's an absolute pleasure to be here, and I'm really pleased the sun's out as well. That makes such a change. Sydney has been as wet as Brisbane recently, so it's nice to have some good weather. So I'm sure that many people here today are familiar with the Lenin quote, "There are decades where nothing happens, and there are weeks where decades happen." It certainly feels like the last few months fit into the latter category. The broad-based nature of the proposed US tariffs, retaliation from major partners, and other potential policy shifts all have the potential to structurally alter the world economy. As recently discussed by our Deputy Governor Andrew Houser, what happens overseas matters for the Australian economy, and all of these events are therefore a key factor in our thinking about the outlook and in monetary policy setting. In the recently released Statement on Monetary Policy, that's our quarterly forecast outlook report, we outlined our thinking on how recent developments will influence the economy here. Now, to help us understand the implications for Australia, we've developed a framework that captures what we think are the key transmission channels from these overseas shocks, and combine this with a set of alternative scenarios that reflect key assumptions and judgments. To Michael's earlier comments, it's very uncertain right now. We don't know precisely how things are going to play out. So we're using scenarios to help us investigate a range of alternatives. Together then, they underpin how our thinking about this environment will flow through the global economy and how we're exposed. And so to start the discussion, the key transmission channels we have identified are, well, trade flows, rather obviously. We think that trade flows between countries are likely to realign as a result of tariffs. And over time, multinational businesses could well start moving their production from one country to another to re-optimize in the new settings. Households and businesses in the countries that apply tariffs are likely to change what they consume. Some products are going to become relatively more expensive, and prices are going to change more generally, and this will prompt changing decisions. Until it's clearer where policy will settle, I think businesses and households are likely to become understandably more cautious, and that might make them potentially delay major decisions, such as whether or not to go ahead with a big capital investment project. Fiscal and monetary policy can, of course, respond, potentially helping to offset some of these adverse or potentially adverse impacts. And financial markets will, or in fact already have responded, by repricing all assets, so equities, bonds, commodity prices, and exchange rates. These moves impact financial conditions, which further feed back through to firms and households' decisions. So there's a lot of moving parts and interlinkages in what I'm going to say today. So I'm going to spend the rest of my time discussing these channels in more detail, including how they are embodied in the scenarios that were presented in the May SMP, which the board obviously saw before they made their decision. Starting with tariffs and global trade flows, economic theory and evidence does suggest that higher global tariffs will put a drag on the global economy, on growth. This is true in both the short and the long run, though here I'm going to focus my attention on the short run, as that is what is most relevant for monetary policy setting today. For the economy or country imposing them, tariffs are a tax on imports. In the short term, this makes imported goods more expensive and pushes up domestic prices, to the extent that the tariff is not offset by lower profit margins for overseas producers or by exchange rate adjustments. Higher import prices will mean less imports and shifts in demand towards locally produced products. But it takes time for domestic businesses to invest and expand. And for some products, such as raw materials, may not be possible for the domestic economy to fill the gap left by imports. So this means that prices are likely to remain higher in the near term. That will reduce households' purchasing power and probably put a drag on business incentives to invest. So collectively then, domestic demand in the tariff-imposing country is likely to fall, all other things equal. And if households expect the tariffs to have a sustained impact on economic growth, and so they think their future incomes are going to be affected, they might also cut back further on spending today. So they're looking ahead and responding today. For the countries that are subject to higher tariffs, that's going to weigh on their export demand, and in turn their broader economic conditions too. Now, domestic stimulus may offset some of these effects. And in the May SMP, our baseline scenario assumes that China will support its economy through expansionary fiscal policy. But for both sets of countries, so those imposing and those on the receiving end of tariffs, any net weakening in demand growth will spill over to their trading partners. So, overall then, weaker global growth, we think, would put near-term downward pressure on prices of globally traded goods. For countries that are not imposing tariffs, such as Australia, this could flow into import prices, making products cheaper and lowering inflation. Now, economists often refer to this as a trade diversion channel. And in the current episode, this channel could be amplified by the nature of the changes. In particular, the US authorities focus on China. As a linchpin of the global manufacturing supply chain, Chinese goods represent a large share of imports for many countries, including us here in Australia. Now, with the US market harder to access, Chinese producers could lower their prices and try to redirect their products to other markets. And we have heard some comments to that effect through our liaison program, but very early days. However, working in the other direction, the broad-based nature of the increase in tariffs and increased use of non-tariff barriers, such as export bans, could create a new bout of supply chain disruptions. By increasing the cost of intermediate inputs that cross borders, such as commodities, machinery and equipment, components that go into high-tech manufacturing, tariffs could potentially lift the cost of production globally. And this could push up consumer prices in all countries, particularly for more complex products such as cars, whose components are typically sourced from a wide range of countries and will cross multiple borders before they end up in the final product itself. Our current baseline scenario assumes that overall, the weaker global growth environment will moderately dampen prices for tradable goods, all other things equal. That is, we expect weaker demand to outweigh the inflationary impact of any supply chain disruptions. We'll be monitoring global trade flows and inflation data closely in the coming months to assess whether this judgment is correct. We could be wrong. We're forecasters. We don't have a crystal ball. Aside from the changes to global trade that I've talked about so far, the unpredictability of where tariffs will settle and changes to other policy settings has the potential to create significant uncertainty, both around the nature of the policies themselves as well as their impact. Now, typically, higher uncertainty leads firms to delay decisions that are costly to reverse, like investment and hiring. And this makes sense intuitively, because there is value in waiting to see how things are playing out before making a decision that is at least partially non-reversible. Sometimes this is referred to as real options value. Now, there's ample research showing that higher uncertainty can lead to declines in investment output and employment, and it's also borne out very clearly in the historical data. So this research suggests that the negative impacts of higher policy uncertainty, and that includes trade policy, tariffs, are largest for businesses, as they typically pull back on investment, delaying those capital projects I mentioned earlier. Some studies find higher uncertainty also has a moderate impact on household consumption, but typically more modest. So firms are impacted more than businesses. Now, uncertainty is a bit of a slippery concept. Lots of different ways of trying to measure it. The graph here shows two of them. One of them, the Global Economic Policy Uncertainty Index, is based on the number of news articles that talk about policy uncertainty. So it's truly a scraping of the internet and other sources. The other, the VIX, is a measure capturing how uncertain markets are, financial markets, about near-term equity prices. It's a measure of their volatility. Now, both, as you can see, have seen a sharp rise in uncertainty recently, although the VIX index has fallen back over the last sort of month after peaking around the 2nd of April. If we see businesses and households respond as they have in the past, then the current level of uncertainty will weigh materially on global activity. But the unpredictability and unprecedented nature of the current situation makes it hard to be precise on the size of the impact. So I said at the start, in the SNP, we've tackled this and many of the assumptions we've had to make by using alternative scenarios that capture smaller or larger responses to this uncertainty. The baseline scenario assumes a relatively modest drag. The trade peace scenario, no significant drag. And the trade war scenario, a substantial pullback in activity. And again, going forward, we'll be looking at how all of this plays out to see which of these assumptions is closest to how things actually unfold. This brings us neatly to financial markets. So movements in global asset prices after the US announced its tariff on April 2nd capture how financial market participants initially evaluated their likely impact. And these moves broadly align. I'm not sure where I'm supposed to point. Oh. There we go. I'll do my best. Technology is not always my friend. And these move broadly aligned with the channels that I've already discussed. So, equity prices, which is what you're looking at, declined sharply, particularly in the US, at least in part reflecting expectations for the direct impact of the tariffs and the indirect impact via slower economic growth on company earnings. Expectations of a lower future growth also meant that expectations for future central bank policy rates declined, which flowed through to bond yields. So markets expected central banks would cut rates more than they previously thought. At the same time, increased uncertainty and risk-led investors to require larger risk premiums to hold on to those risky assets. This was reflected in increased spreads on corporate bonds and some increases in equity risk premia that put further downward pressure on equity prices. So in other words, investors wanted more compensation for holding riskier assets because they were less sure about the environment and how it was going to play out. So they required a higher return in exchange. Now, some of these movements unwound in the following weeks after pauses in implementation of some tariffs. As of 30th of May, the end of last month, financial market participants appear to be pricing in some downside risk to global growth, but they're no longer pricing in a material economic downturn. Consistent with this, expectations for central bank rate cuts have also been pared back. Still, there remains a risk that further changes to tariffs or other policy settings or actual economic outcomes prompt financial markets to downgrade the outlook, which leads risky asset prices to fall sharply. If this were to occur, it would lead to a more sustained tightening in financial conditions, which would make it more expensive for businesses in particular to borrow or raise funds for investment. This outcome is embodied in the trade war downside scenario we presented in the May SNP. And this response of financial markets and financial conditions is a significant amplifier of the initial shock generated by the sharp hike in tariffs. Now, one financial market that deserves some deeper discussion is the exchange rate. It's a very important variable for Australia as a small, open economy. When the outlook for global growth weakens, the Australian dollar typically depreciates, that is, falls in value, as investors expect our economy to be buffeted by the global headwinds and the RBA to respond to that with cuts to the cash rate. The depreciation of the exchange rate makes our exports cheaper in foreign currency terms, which offsets some of the effect of weaker global demand. An additional driver of the Australian dollar in times of uncertainty is its status as a risk-sensitive currency. When global investors are worried, they tend to focus on reducing their risk exposure, moving their capital to low-risk assets in countries like the US, Switzerland, and Japan. This means the Australian dollar tends to lose value against these currencies over and above the depreciation linked to weaker growth and expected cuts in the cash rate. Now, this dynamic partly explains the movements through the global financial crisis when the Australian dollar declined very sharply, even though the Australian economy was much less exposed to the global downturn. Now, ex ante, they might have expected a bigger impact on the economy. We don't think it can explain everything. So, while the initial response of the Australian dollar during the current episode was in line with historical experience, the recent recovery against the US dollar in particular has been more unusual. The exchange rate has been volatile over recent months, but on a trade-weighted basis, that's the black line on this chart, it's little changed overall, back to where it started. So we have appreciated against the US dollar, and therefore also against currencies like the Chinese renminbi and other currencies that are pegged to the US dollar. But the currency, the Australian dollar, has depreciated against most other major currencies. This appears to reflect some offsetting factors. Concerned about the growth outlook and related risk-off dynamics I just talked about, we think have contributed to the Australian dollar's depreciation relative to several other currencies. But at the same time, some investors, at least, have reduced their exposure to US assets, leading to broad US dollar weakness. So the US dollar's depreciated against most currencies globally. The weakening in the US dollar during a period of heightened risk is in contrast to many previous episodes, although it is too early to know whether this dynamic will continue. And the return of the trade-weighted index to its pre-shock value means that, on average, the price of our exports in foreign currency terms hasn't actually changed. But the relative move of capital towards Australian assets compared to the US, that reflects an increase in capital inflows again from the US, which could support domestic investment activity over time. And so we'll be monitoring to see how these channels play out, that impact from the exchange rate versus that reallocation, and the extent that that continues as well. Now, as previously outlined, when global conditions deteriorate and uncertainty increases, Australia's exports would typically benefit from the currency depreciating. Although this channel may well be less pronounced, as I just said, than in other episodes, we actually think that Australia's exports are relatively well placed to weather the storm. This is because the fundamentals underpinning our exports make it likely that in volume terms at least, they'll be relatively less impacted than other countries. Beginning first with the direct exposure to the US, higher US tariffs on Australian exports are unlikely to have a material impact, as Australian exports to the US only account for around 1.5% of Australian GDP, a low share compared with other countries. As you can see on the chart, we're right on the left-hand side as you're looking at it on the screen. Other countries have got much larger levels, higher levels of exposure as you move towards the right. Furthermore, the structure and composition of Australia's exports will potentially provide an additional buffer. Resources make up around 75% of Australian goods exports, and despite the exposure of China and other resource-intensive countries to the tariff shock, we might expect export volumes to remain resilient in the short run. This is because Australian resource export volumes are less sensitive to movements in global demand than other producers, as we are a relatively low-cost producer of bulk commodities like iron ore. Now, you can see this on the chart. Most Australian iron ore miners are sitting on the lower left end of the production cost curve, so their costs of production are well below current market prices, which is the line on the chart. So short-run declines in commodity prices tend to lead to reduced volumes from other higher-cost producers, who are further to the right, while Australian producers feel the impact via lower prices and so earnings. Now, so far, the current episode has not seen a sharp correction in Australia's key commodity prices, and that's been underpinned by a relatively positive outlook for China. This view assumes that the Chinese authorities will support their economy through fiscal stimulus, and as I said earlier, it's embodied in our baseline scenario. The downside trade war scenario encapsulates a correction in commodity prices. So in that scenario, we assume the Chinese authorities aren't able to fully offset the impact of tariffs and commodity prices do fall. If this were to occur, the income flows from commodity exports would fall significantly, even if volumes are relatively unimpacted. Now, in contrast to commodities, trade in services, which accounts for around 20% of Australian exports to the world, they are much more responsive to changes in global demand and the exchange rate. We can see this in this chart, which shows historically how movements of services export volumes have correlated with changes in the real exchange rate, which is a measure of competitiveness. In the years following the GFC, the appreciation initially and then depreciation of the Australian dollar contributed to first a decline and then a strong rebound in services export volumes. Now, trade in services tends to react more strongly because at least some of these services are easier to substitute and they're more discretionary. Travel services, for example, tourism. It's a key Australian export. Maybe people in the room work in that sector. And that might be affected by recent developments. Weaker global growth is likely to dampen demand, but any exchange rate depreciation will make Australia a more attractive destination compared to other countries. Simultaneously, travel service imports, that's outward tourism, when we go overseas for our holidays, that may decline if the Australian dollar depreciates. Holidaying overseas will become more expensive than taking a trip locally, say down the road to the Gold Coast. Now, while key parts of Australia's export volumes may be relatively resilient to global demand conditions and uncertainty, domestic demand is unlikely to be completely insulated. As discussed earlier, greater uncertainty about the future can lead households and businesses to save instead of spending and investing. And this is likely to be the case for Australian households and businesses too. And increased borrowing costs and risk premium in global financial markets could spill into our domestic financial markets, and that would further weigh on activity. Now, previous research by RBA economist Angus Moore found exactly this. Higher global uncertainty has a large negative effect on Australian business investment, while the negative effect on consumption is more modest. And though the magnitude of these effects is itself very uncertain right now, does suggest that global uncertainty may weigh significantly on domestic activity if uncertainty remains elevated. And again, that's our trade war scenario. As with all of the other channels, we have explored this through different assumptions in the scenarios in the May SMP. So to finish up, how will all of the current unpredictability and uncertain global environment transmit through to the Australian economy? Well, the short answer is we can't be completely sure. We don't know precisely. The framework I've outlined earlier through this speech identifies what we think are the key transmission mechanisms, and we've used scenarios to simulate different alternatives. Within this range, the baseline forecast is for recent global developments to contribute to slower economic growth in Australia than we previously thought, and a slightly weaker labour market. We also anticipate that overall, the price of tradable goods will be slightly dampened. And together, these two outcomes mean that underlying inflation is forecast to be a little lower than we thought back in February, settling around the midpoint of the 2-3% target range. Now, this forecast is based on several judgments and assumptions about the potency of the transmission channels I have discussed today. Just to recap, it's a long list. This includes how tariff policies evolve, how fiscal and monetary authorities around the world respond, whether trade diversion reduces the price of imports or global supply chain disruptions become significant and so add to prices, how much uncertainty weighs on economic activity, and how financial markets respond, in particular the exchange rate. So by using the frameworks and scenarios together, we've anchored our thinking and tried to cut through some of the uncertainty about the outlook. Again, we don't know it all, but we're hoping the framework's going to help us navigate through. And these were provided to the Monetary Policy Board to help inform their decision making. Taking all of the information into account and considering the risks to the outlook, they decided to cut the cash rate by 25 basis points. And what we'll be doing from here on? Well, we're going to be monitoring the domestic and international outcomes and policy developments. And we're going to be benchmarking what happens against the scenarios that we showed in the May SMP to help us identify which one is looking like it's the closest fit or best reflecting current conditions. And this will enable the board to adjust policy settings accordingly. Thank you. And I'm looking forward to taking some questions.
Thanks, everyone. Michael and Sarah will now have a Q&A. We'll just set up briefly. I just thought I'd say What fabulous charts. So when I was in Treasury, we used to have competitions, I remember, who could produce the killer chart, the best charts, and there was a lot of prestige. I mean, there wasn't any money or anything or any real prizes or promotions, but I mean, my favourite chart of all, I don't know whether you agree, but that one of the iron ore production by different mines and the relationship with the price, that was brilliant. So whoever did that chart in the RBA, I think they win that chart competition. I also love the impulse response. You'll only see impulse response functions from a vector auto regression in an RBA talk, but that was good too. Interesting stuff. Okay, thanks. I'll hand over to Michael Knox and Sarah.
Sarah, you and I were having a furious discussion about some economic issues previously, and I have a couple of questions to ask you. There is a popular view amongst Australian economists that Treasury is much better at forecasting inflation and the RBA is much better at forecasting GDP. Now, you've been on both sides of this question. So, is this true, and why do you think it's true?
Thank you, Michael. I'll just say I will take the chart compliment back to headquarters. Our international team will very much appreciate that. So to answer your question, well, actually, my response when we were over lunch was to say I actually hadn't come across that view before and I hadn't heard that view before. And I was very short time at Treasury, less time than I've been at the RBA so far, so I can't comment too much on Treasury. But in terms of the RBA forecast, we do actually review our forecasts every year. We think it's best practice to do so. We're always learning. We don't always get it right, and we really want to identify why we get it wrong. So we spend an awful lot of time on stuff where we've gone wrong, and we spend a bit less time where we've got right. But, you know, looking at it holistically. It's been interesting, actually, just recently, so our last review was done in November last year. It's actually the opposite of what you just said. Our misses had been much more on GDP and much less on inflation. Maybe that's the exception that proves your rule. But in general, what we found over the recent period is actually the disinflation that we were expecting had come through, so inflation was falling, obviously very good news for us. But on the GDP side, we found that we seem to expect that household spending in particular would come through a little more strongly than it has. And so we spent a lot of time investigating why that is and digging into it. But that was last year's review. Other reviews will give you a different answer. And I'm afraid I don't have a good answer to your question because I've not looked at the question. But we'll take that back and perhaps we can correspond on it once we've had a chance to look at the numbers.
So the next discussion we were having was about the level of inflation happens in wartime. And I was talking about the American Civil War where the price level at the end was 2.35 times what it was at the start. So I was going to ask you, since your speciality is the Great War and the British economy in the Great War, what sort of inflation did the UK have at that time that made it so difficult to go back on the gold standard when it was over?
An incredibly interesting time. I have to say, when I did my PhD, I did think that the research skills and the technical knowledge I gained and writing and presenting would be useful in my career, but I didn't expect the subject material to necessarily be useful. So that period also included the Spanish flu, which was the last truly global, very disruptive pandemic. So 2020 was a good year for me, and now I'm reusing the knowledge again. So I have to say, it's a bit of a tale as old as time. The inflation that was generated was really the relaxing of a lot of constraints that were put in place during World War I for obvious reasons, and a big influx of men coming back from the front, and it just really drove inflation. Supply chain disruptions on a scale. Actually, I mean, we thought COVID was bad. That period was far worse. So lots of things coming together to generate that big inflation. And really the struggle the British economy had was when they returned to the gold standard. That's for those that don't know, that's like pegging your exchange rate.
when they returned to the gold standard, they pegged at the wrong value. They tried to peg at a too high a value, too overvalued. And in that situation, what tends to happen is financial markets will run your currency. They won't believe your peg is credible, and they'll sell your currency. And for the Bank of England at the time, they had to buy lots and lots of sterling to hold the value up. And in the end, actually, they did leave the gold standard in the early 1930s. So a whole host of other shocks happened then, as I'm sure everyone knows. So it was an interesting period where the monetary policy framework, very, very different. The Bank of England no longer has to worry about a pegged exchange rate. It inflation targets, as does the RBA. Obviously, very different settings here as well. But it's fascinating how the interplay of those types of shocks and what they can do to price levels then can come together in terms of what you decide to do with your monetary policy settings and your currency. I'm glad to say, I think, that central bankers and economists more broadly, we've learned a lot from that period, and we're not trying to repeat the mistakes, which I think is very good.
But you haven't answered my question. How much did prices go up?
I don't know the precise number. I mean, a very big multiple. It was certainly a very big multiple.
Okay. Questions from the audience, please. There's a should be a roving mic, and anybody who wants to ask. Aha. There's a Morgan's director wants to... I'm going to ask a question.
Thanks, Sarah, for the presentation. Just a question about the CPI and the inflation measure that we look at some of the sort of constituents of that when we see rents up by 20%, we see the basket of groceries up 30%, and I just wonder, how on earth do we see an inflation rate of 3% when we're seeing 20 and 30% rises in a whole lot of prices that affect us?
Yeah, no, excellent question. So it's the answer to your question is the difference between the price level and the inflation rate. So the price level increases you're talking about, that's the sort of size of the increase in the price of things from pre-COVID times, so from sort of early 2020-ish, more or less. And in that time, you're absolutely right. All products have gone up in price pretty much. And on average, it's by about 25%, something in that ballpark. So similar to the numbers you were just mentioning. But that's over that sort of 5 and a bit year period now. Incredible to think it's 5 years since the start of COVID. That increase in prices has played out through a bit of a cycle. So in the early part of COVID, we didn't have much inflation through the economy. Very weak, obviously we were in lockdown, things like that. Some prices went up, but many didn't. And then as we came out of lockdown, we had a burst of inflation, and inflation got up to almost 8% at one point. So it was a big increase for over just 1 year. Now we're on coming down the other side. And so the rate of increase of prices over the last 12 months, headline CPI has been actually low 2%. The underlying inflation rate that we measure is high twos, just below 3%. But that is just over the last year. It's not measuring the increase over that five-year period, and that's the difference that you're talking about. But I understand completely. I mean, you know, when I'm going to the shops and doing our weekly shop, I still find it astounding how much I have to pay for milk in particular as my product of choice. I'm amazed at how much milk costs now compared to pre-COVID. I used to think it was $1 a litre, so $1 for 1 litre, 2 for 2, and so on. It is not that now, and it catches me every time, but that's the reason why. So the rate of increases has come down. That's really what we're looking to see at the RBA. That's what we want as an outcome. We want low and stable inflation. But the price level, it won't go back to where it was before. We are all going to have to get used to higher prices, so I've just got to make my peace with milk costing significantly more than $1 a litre. It's never going back there.
Yes.
Yeah, we had we got through to 2022 and we saw 4.25% of interest rates hikes, probably the steepest hikes that we ever had, but property prices held up, spending in the economy was pretty good. You know, is monetary policy less effective now, or has it been mitigated by other things like government spending and perhaps, you know, some other factors? Would you mind just commenting on government spending, the other factors, maybe your view on that?
Yeah, so so in terms of the trajectory for monetary policy through the last couple of years, so as you say, the hike started in May 22, and the last one was in November 23, and now we've actually had a couple of cuts. In terms of that trajectory and what the board were trying to achieve through that period, they were very much trying to achieve an outcome where we brought inflation back down. So inflation at 8%, too high. We don't want it that high. High inflation hurts everybody. It's particularly challenging for those on a low income who are already in a pretty tough spot to start with, and then if prices are moving that fast, it's really hard for them. But it's challenging for everyone. So we wanted to bring inflation, the board wanted to bring inflation back down. That's consistent with our mandate. But they wanted to achieve that and retain as much of the gains in the labour market. So your comment on, you know, spending holding up effectively showed up as jobs holding up, the unemployment rate being historically low. They wanted to retain as many of those gains as was possible. And so the trajectory for interest rates and the decisions they were making was to try and achieve that outcome. Now, we won't say that the job is done. The job is never done. I'm paid to worry. Your taxes pay for me to worry. I do worry. This is quite not a great job for my cortisone levels. So I'm never going to say the job is done. But certainly where we are, or where we were sort of pre-April the 2nd, we had inflation, was back in the target band. We had an unemployment rate that was, you know, around about 4%, low fours, 4.1, very, you know, low historically. And that was, if we could hold it there, that would be a great outcome. In terms of setting the policy and other factors we consider, and you mentioned a few, absolutely, we consider all of those things. So interest rates are not the only thing that impacts the economy. We're responding to all of the different factors that flow through us. I obviously spent my time today talking about international conditions, but other domestic settings, such as fiscal settings, matter as well. So we're considering all of that in our analysis that we do and in the advice that we provide to the board, and we're trading all of those things off. And then the board are making their decision about interest rates to ultimately try and achieve that inflation and full employment mandate. That was what they were doing through that period, and let's hope that we can hold where we are now, broadly speaking, because if we can achieve that, I think that would be a great outcome for the country. But that's a tough job, and that's the job for the next few years.
Okay.
Just over here.
Yes.
Just
following on, Lexi Hamilton-Smith from the ABC, just following on from your comments about inflation, the 3.5% pay rise with the Fair Work Commission, is there any comments you can give us at all talking about your inflation that is around 2.4%? I know it's only just happened this morning.
Indeed, and I have to say I was preparing and reading my speech this morning, so I did see the number flash, but I have not looked at any of the details, and I haven't spoken to my team in Sydney who are digging into that, so I'm sorry, I can't give you any comments right now.
Okay, no problem.
Yes.
Hi, Sarah. Jorge here from the University of Queensland. Thank you very much. Very interesting. So you talked about scenarios like forecast. I think...
Yes.
Okay. Is the RBA considering providing all a path for the future evolution of the interest rate, given all these forecasts? Some banks, like the Bank of Chile, do it, and that would be super useful. I wonder if you are pushing for this.
That's not something we're considering at the moment. Forward guidance of that form is a pretty tricky thing to provide as a central bank, because it can be very hard to communicate fully all of the caveats around that forward path. So it really does depend on everything that's going on and a certain set of circumstances becoming true. And as soon as one thing changes, what that path might look like can change as well. And as you might imagine, at the moment, there is an awful lot that could change the board's decision. Our advice to the board, and then their actual decision based on that advice. So it's really tricky. What we do for interest rates in terms of when we set our baseline forecast is we use what the financial markets expect the cash rate to do. So they have an evolution in financial markets. That's what underpins our baseline forecast. It's also what runs through all of the scenarios as well, so they're all very consistent with one another. But there's, the board absolutely do not guarantee that that's what's actually going to happen. Far from it. They don't, they haven't made that decision. That decision will come in the future. And that's how we build our advice, and then they have their discussions. But no, we don't have any plans to publish a profile that comes from the bank itself.
So we have 10 minutes more for more questions. So at the back there. Yeah, oh. The back. Yeah.
Sorry, I'll just jump in. Just a question on the currency. You referenced it in your speech. It's sort of gone from 60 to 65 as we've gone through the tariff turmoil. How much of the Aussie dollar appreciation is US dollar depreciation? And what are, if that continues and the Aussie dollar continues to rally, as some people are calling a sort of end to US exceptionalism, how much sort of, what are the potential implications for that, do you think?
Yeah, excellent question. So you're absolutely right. The movement against the US dollar in particular, that's a reflection of broad-based US dollar depreciation. So the US dollar has depreciated against many, many currencies over the last month or so. The Australian dollar is one of them. And on a trade-weighted basis for us, that also flows through into the Chinese renminbi, because they peg their currency to the US dollar. So the US dollar moves have been reflected in a very large part in the Chinese currency as well, and in other currencies that are pegged to the US dollar. In terms of how that might play forward, this is an active area of research for us, very much so. We're looking at this and we're thinking about it all the time. That sits in our international department. The short answer is we don't precisely know. What we do know is that this kind of move must be a reflection of a rebalancing of financial market flows away from US dollar assets in general towards assets in other countries. And you can look at the relative moves across countries. Some have gained more than others, and so that tells you where the capital is flowing to. Whether it continues or not, though, is a good question. We don't know the answer. It's something we're monitoring. And we're interested as well in whether or not these flows just reflect a change in the flow of new capital, as it were, through the economy, or if it's a change in the stock positions held by investors. That's something that we're investigating too, but it is very early days. We're only a month into it, so we'll see how it plays out over the rest of this year and beyond. That's really when we'll know the answer to your question.
Hi, Sarah. Christine Dowd from Queensland Economic Teachers Association. We're representing the students here today. Just wondering, how much do you worry about the structural change coming from the movement towards more spending in defence across the world? I'm from a generation towards the end of the Cold War. I could see that spending, and I've seen certainly economies benefit from the fact that they are not in that wartime setting of having to put more and more into defence. But for the young students here, they're in looking towards a different type of world as well. So how much do you worry?
Great. Thank you for your question. And thank you for bringing your students here and for the work that you do. I'm so pleased that people like you are bringing through the next generation of economists. And I would really love to see one of your students up on this stage in 20 years when I'm long gone from the job doing it. That would be fabulous. It's an excellent question. So in terms of monetary policy and how we think about the economy in the short run, the example of defence spending is sort of one example of where you can get additional spending through the economy that in that case would obviously come from be part of fiscal spending more broadly. We think about that in the context of thinking about what are all of those conditions across the whole economy, what is the outlook for all of these things, and for that type of spending we'd use government budgets. We don't forecast it ourselves, we use what the government expects to spend and push that through our numbers. And we'd be factoring that into domestic demand conditions and then providing our advice around monetary policy accordingly. As a longer run structural shift, though, you're right, these are big changes if they come to pass, big changes for the economy to work its way through over a number of years beyond the two-year horizon, which is typically the horizon we're looking at. And I suppose my general observation is that there are a number of different sort of tracks of spending or increasing size of the economy for a number of sectors, defence perhaps, the climate transition, all of these other factors. That's something that many countries are going to have to work through, Australia included, but that will be, I think, a more medium long-term transition over maybe a 5, even 10, beyond that year horizon.
Yes, thank you. Sarah, you said earlier on in your speech, you said, you know, traditional economic thought is that raising tariffs has a negative impact on economic growth. I think you said words to that effect. If you put yourself in the White House and put a sort of a US White House lens on the question, can you see a valid economic argument for the introduction of tariffs in terms, and I guess to think out loud here, obviously, there's increased tax revenue, and that tax revenue can go in some way to economic growth. Can you help us understand if you see a valid economic argument for imposition of tariffs?
So when economists say that tariffs generally have a negative impact on output or global growth, we're looking at that very much through the a lens of how our resources are allocated around the world. And so from a purely sort of activity perspective, what you want is for everybody to take advantage of their comparative advantage, and then the world economy should be as big as it possibly can be. And that's a very simplistic trade theory view of the world. I wouldn't ever presume to sort of give advice to any government, domestic or otherwise. But it's certainly true that governments have a number of competing objectives that they're trying to meet, and not all of them push in the same direction. So there are many reasons why you might want to impose a tariff that, wouldn't be necessarily produce the outcome I just talked about, but that's just looking at things through one lens. So there are many competing objectives for governments, no matter what decision they're trying to make. It's a tough job, as my introduction said. I worked in the federal government for a while. And they're balancing a lot of trade-offs, and this is, an example of that.
Sarah, thank you for your presentation today. My name's Daniel. I work for the SAS Group. We're a government and media relations firm, and we work with a range of clients who are looking to invest or to deploy capital. Can you make some comments and maybe some observations in some specific policy areas around productivity? It seems to be a big issue at the moment and will continue to be. In this, particularly from a political point of view in our world, what that might look like, what sort of policy settings that government could look at in that space and would give some sovereignty and some security to investors, particularly including global capital.
Yeah, it's an excellent question, and it's clearly a very hot topic of conversation. What I would say is that monetary policy really doesn't have much of a role to play in supporting productivity growth or indeed dampening it. The one thing we do know that it is incredibly useful for us to provide is low and stable inflation. So inflation in the background that no one has to worry about, that just sort of ticks along. So you're not having to wonder if a price increase is because your products are more attractive and you should invest, or is it just that prices are going up a lot in general? I'm not sure. If we can take that off the table, and that's what we're trying to do, then that's one less thing to worry about. So that's our role in all of this. More generally, in terms of policies that that can help with productivity growth, I always like to defer to my friend Danielle Wood, who runs the Productivity Commission. That is very much her space and domain. Her team are excellent, and I know are doing a lot of work on a number of these issues. So I, like everyone else, will be reading what comes out from them. But I'll send you in her direction. She's much better placed than me.
So we have time for only one more question. Do we have a...
Hi, yeah. Yes. Hi, Sarah. Thank you very much for your talk today. So you've talked a lot about this unsurety about justifications by the US, and you also talked a lot about, currency appreciation and depreciation. So I had a question. I was reading an article written by the US Treasurer, Scott Bessent, and he talks largely about strengthening not only US manufacturing, but also the US dollar. Given that the US are running one of the largest federal deficits in history, do you think that reshoring American manufacturing in order to decrease the trade deficit could increase the strength of the US dollar?
Yeah, it's an excellent question. And it comes back a little bit to the earlier question about competing aims in government and objectives and how things play out when you throw everything into the pot and give it a mix. Economic theory can tell you that if you impose a tariff, that can appreciate your currency. So that could be an underpinning for that view. But that's a very all other things equal view of the world. It doesn't really consider financial market flows and a whole range of other things that might influence what happens in terms of capital markets, which is really what determines exchange rate movements. So unfortunately, the answer to your question is maybe, but it depends, and it's not possible to be definitive. And the one thing I can say, though, to be a bit more definitive, is we will find out because we are living through this, but unfortunately, we're going to have to wait a year or two to know the answer for sure. But thank you for your question. It's a great question.
Thank you. That brings us to the end of question time. So now Sarah and I will go back to the table, and John Clifford, Managing Director of Morgans Financial, will come up to give a vote of thanks.
Okay. Well, ladies and gentlemen, what a great presentation and some fantastic questioning and debate there. Thank you for playing your role in that. Morgan's has proudly sponsored this event for as long as I can remember. We are ever thankful for the ESA and Jean in particular for organising such a great event and for including Morgan's as a major sponsor. Being Australia's largest wealth management firm, Morgan's really value the opportunity to take part in this forum and in the conversations on important topics such as state of the economy, global trade, tariffs, interest rates, inflation, and so on. Now, obviously, I think the theme for today was uncertainty, and we've all seen and tasted that in recent months. And whilst it certainly seems very acute at the moment, if you recall, for those that attended this presentation last year with Andrew Houser presenting, there was huge uncertainty about interest rates. And as we heard today, it's not the genie's not quite back in the bottle, but it's perhaps very close. So good to see that that's moved on. This year we've got trade wars and tariffs, and I guarantee you next year it'll be something else, which we don't quite know about yet. But I think it's fantastic to know that we've got people of Sarah's calibre at the RBA looking after policy settings that keep us out of trouble. So thank you, Sarah. We're thank you. We're delighted and privileged that you could make the effort to come to Brisbane and present today. And the RBA's ongoing support of this very important lunch series is greatly appreciated. Your insights, and more importantly, the opportunity to engage in discussion, as we've just heard, is certainly very valued by the Queensland business community. I'd like to also call out the fantastic representation from the schools here today. Great to be able to expose our next generation of economists to such great conversation and the RBA's presence. So I'm sure you appreciated that, guys. And I know from helping my kids with economics assignments over the past 5 or 10 years as they went through school, there was barely a word mentioned about tariffs. It was all about globalisation and free trade agreements. So obviously some of those textbooks you're reading might need a revamp in the next couple of years. Good luck with that, teachers. Ladies and gentlemen, on that note, I'd like to again thank Sarah for her great presentation today. If you could join me with thanking her once again. Thank you.
Right, thanks everyone. That concludes the lunch. Thanks for coming. Thanks to Sarah for presenting. Great presentation. Thanks to Morgan's for sponsorship, to John, to Michael for the great Q&A, and to Donna for helping us out with getting people in the room. So thanks so much. And thanks to Sally Porteous and Haley from Red Lanyard for their help too. To Christine from Keta for bringing so many skilled children. I hope you really enjoyed that, got something out of it. And it helps you out with your studies. That could be a side benefit of it, so let's hope. And you choose to study economics at university, so we want to see that. We want to see good people coming through in the profession. So I'm the president of the society. Our role is to promote the study and the application of economics. We've got an AGM coming up on Wednesday, 18 June at UniSQ, so please come along to that if you want to have more brilliant discussion of economic issues, tariffs and terms of trade. And we can talk about some of those charts that we saw today, or your own charts if you want to bring some. We'll love talking about charts. Okay, so annual general meeting, and then we've got various other events. We've got a very active Women in Economics Network. The President of WEN is here, Fred Reek. They always have great linked up events. Check that out on our website. They've got a couple more this year. So ESA. Queensland.org.au. Righto, thanks everyone for coming and look forward to seeing you at a future event. Thank you.